You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there have been calls from both parties for new regulations on big technology companies, including social media platforms. We'll find out what kind of changes could be in the works for social media in Silicon Valley. Now, in his final hours in office, former President Trump issued pardons and clemency to a big group of people. And he revoked a rule that went into effect during his presidency, restricting when former administration members would be allowed to take up lobbying positions. Our next guest says both of those moves raised big questions about ethics in government. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the way presidents in general use their power to pardon? Do you think it's a good thing to have, a good option to have for presidents? And what do you think about what President Trump in particular did over the last day or so of his term? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Jordan Libowitz is communications director for the nonprofit Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Jordan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get to President Trump's particular pardons, can you talk about the power in general, kind of what it's there for, the positive sides of it, and the potential for misuse?
Absolutely. The presidential pardon power is a good thing. It allows the president to pardon people for federal crimes, like a governor can pardon for state crimes, who are wrongly convicted or have changed their lives, their sentence no longer fits the crime, or it allows people to remove the stigma of having a conviction on their record. What it was not meant for was a gift to be used for the president's corrupt supporters. And that is, to a certain extent, how we've seen Trump use it.
And again, before we tackle Trump's pardons in particular, past controversies, there were debates over Gerald Ford in his first days in the office, pardoning his predecessor, Richard Nixon, Bill Clinton coming out of office, pardoning his brother and a donor, Mark Rich. Have we seen much in the way of what you would say is misuse of the pardon power in the past?
So there's always, you know, one or two controversial pardons for each president, especially when they are pardoning hundreds, if not thousands of people or commuting their sentences. Trump did not pardon a ton of people compared to some previous presidents. But what's particularly interesting is that it's not one or two people connected to him. You can make the argument that, which Ford did, that the nation needed to move on from Nixon. And if he didn't pardon him, it would be hard to focus on anything else. Whether or not that was the right decision, it was a thought out one. Clinton's pardon of his donor, Mark Rich, in his final days was definitely very controversial, probably more so than an old drug conviction for his brother. But again, that's kind of one or two people. So you always expect one or two, but it has been a running theme, especially over the last month or so, of how this president has used them.
Let's get into this president's use of pardons and commutation now. One category that I think caught a lot of people's attention was former government officials, members of Congress, Governor Blagojevich, not part of this new batch, but a former governor of Illinois, people who had been charged and convicted with various forms of political corruption, mostly Republicans, couple Democrats in list too, including Blagojevich. Take a look at that category for us.
Absolutely. It's almost like the president picked the most corrupt former legislators still alive to give pardons to. So you have the ones that really jumped out to us. And this includes, as you said, some that came out a couple months ago. We saw Duncan Hunter and Chris Collins, congressmen from California and New York, respectively. Duncan Hunter used his campaign card, used his campaign donor money to pay for a really extravagant life for his family, as well as to fund affairs he was having, jewelry for his wife, restaurants, trips to Italy, Disney World. That got Duncan Hunter a pardon. A new one, Duke Cunningham, another congressman from California, had a literal menu of bribes that he would give people, saying, if you want this, this is how much you have to give me. There was a yacht on it. So seeing people like them, Rick Renzi of Arizona, when Trump ran for office, it was a drain the swamp was what we heard over and over again, to remove the stain of, you know, corrupt money in politics from D.C. And what we saw here was a reward for the essentially the swampiest members of Congress and former elected officials.
Right. And the examples you're giving there aren't, you know, people look at campaign donations as a form of potential corruption. These are like old style corruption cases you're pointing toward, where people are either personally profiting or, you know, yeah, getting personal gain from their campaign funds or their public office. Do you worry about the message these pardons send then to future office holders?
Absolutely. There's always a fear that when you are prosecuting someone in the government who's well-connected, that with a single, you know, swipe of the pen, the whole prosecution could disappear. We saw some of the president's closest advisors and campaign supporters openly pushing for a pardon, like Roger Stone, who and Michael Flynn, who eventually got them. You know, this is in stark contrast to Richard Nixon, who famously refused to pardon Ehrlichman and Haldeman on the way out, even though they were very publicly trying to get pardons. There's a famous story of them calling everyone they could find and running all over the White House on his last day trying to get the president's attention to get a pardon. But, you know, Nixon didn't pardon his political cronies. And that was kind of the bar we were hoping for, but that was unfortunately not what we saw. You know, as you know, the pardons came out in the middle of the night at about 12:30 a.m. Our time, even though they had been ready for over 12 hours at that point, because the White House was battling the president not to include Steve Bannon, his former advisor, who, again, is that kind of old style of corruption of defrauding donors from the We Build the Wall campaign. And this is almost the ultimate form of grift, in that Trump pardoned a Trump supporter who defrauded Trump donors. So a lot of these things aren't, aren't kind of that gray area. The DOJ doesn't often bring political cases or cases against people in politics in a gray area. They go for the kind of clear cut stuff, like with Duncan Hunter. So this has been kind of a fairly scary message that you can do these things and get away with them. And this is somewhat of a silver lining, or more damning with faint praise, but we were worried he was going to try to pardon himself, although that probably would not have stood up in court, but pardon his children, or what, you know, the big fear was pardon the people who attacked the Capitol 2 weeks ago. So it's great that we did not see that, but that doesn't make us happy about what we did see.
We're talking to Jordan Leibowitz from Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. We're talking about the final pardons and commutations done by President Trump in his final hours in office. And coming up, we'll look at the revoking of an ethics order that would have barred many of his staffers from entering lobbying firms. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the former president's use of the pardon power? Do you think There need to be changes in how pardons are reviewed. And what about ethics guidelines? What do you think about members of a presidential team going to work for lobbyists soon after leaving office? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about pardons and executive orders, specifically ones former President Trump took action on just before his term as president ended. Jordan Libowitz is with us from Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. You can join in with your comments and questions at 800-642-1234. Did you follow the late breaking story of the president's pardons on his way out of office? What do you think of the decisions that were made there? Do you think rules need to be tightened up on when people who leave, say, a White House team can go and work in lobbying? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Pamela is with us in Madison. Pamela, hi.
Hi. I read recently about a type of pardon that President Trump could have issued but wouldn't necessarily become public. I can't remember if it was called private or secret pardon, and it would be legally valid, but might not ever be known publicly, or maybe not known unless somebody was prosecuted, and then their defense was, hey, I've been pardoned by the president. So I was wondering about that.
Pamela, thanks for the call. I don't know. I've heard rumors about that. Jordan, is that something you're watching for?
So I'm not sure exactly about that. They did not have to publicize the pardons in a release or tell the media about it. But had they done it, it should have been available through public records requests.
Pamela, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Jordan, I want to also bring up, I mentioned it earlier, the president on his way into office instituted a 5-year ban on staff members going to work for lobbyists after his term was up. He had criticized the Clinton administration for reversing its own ban back when they left office. And now that ban revoked by an executive order again toward the end of the president's term. Could you talk about that and what you make of it?
Yeah, so a president puts into place something called an ethics agreement or an ethics pledge. President Biden released his today that anyone working for the administration signs. What we saw was that his last act as president late in the night was to rescind his own ethics pledge and have the people who signed it no longer have to follow by it so they could immediately become lobbyists and represent foreign countries. And that is kind of the catch of it, is that if the president put it into place, the president can take it away. But there is something that can be done about that. The For the People Act, which is H.R. 1 in the House and S.1 in the Senate, would turn ethics pledge rules into law so a president could no longer pull them back after they'd been signed.
Do you think that's something that's going to get passed, that there's an appetite for, to actually take this thing that's been left to executive order and actually institutionalize it?
So there's a lot of great stuff in the bills. H.R. 1 actually passed the House 2 years ago and did not come up for vote in the Senate. We feel really good about it. Essentially, they would not have assigned it as the first bill if it were not super important and not something they thought they had a good chance of passing. But definitely, you know, if you believe that this is something that should be done, call your Congress member, call your senator, and tell them to support the For the People Act.
Can you talk about the why? What concerns do you have if members of, again, like key advisors to a president, members of a White House staff, as you know, right when they leave office, can go to work for lobbying firms? What kind of worries does that have for you?
Absolutely. So the idea is that you wouldn't lobby your people you used to work with. People used to work for, you should not be capitalizing off your connections. The pledges also kind of go the other way, because sometimes we see people leave the administration and then come back later on. So they tend to prevent people from coming directly in as a lobbyist and then doing favors for their previous clients. It essentially comes down to President Eisenhower's warning about the military-industrial complex. You don't want the government and the private contractors that the government buys for so closely entwined, because then you start questioning whether decisions are being made in the best interest of the American people or in the best interest of well-connected companies. So we're always in favor of tighter restrictions on lobbying and lobbyists.
Talking to Jordan Leibowitz from Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, talking about a couple actions on the last day of the Trump administration, some controversial pardons, revoking an ethics guideline for staffers, allowing them now to go and work for lobbyists. Back to your calls now. Ken is with us in Blanchardville. Ken, hi.
Hi. This is a great program. Thanks, guys. My question, well, kind of referring to Steve Bannon, but anybody who fits in that category, he's received a pardon. But there's an ongoing investigation. So I'm assuming he could still be called to testify based on the investigation that he's getting pardoned for. So if he lies under oath, could he then be recharged for his crimes and basically negating the pardon?
Ken, thanks for the call. Might get into tricky legal territory. I don't know, Jordan, but I believe a pardon applies to crimes committed to that date. They're not a get-out-of-jail-free card for future crimes. Do I have that about right?
So there would be the double jeopardy issue of they couldn't charge him with the same crime again. But I think what the caller might be referring to is the crime of perjury. And if he were to perjure himself while testifying, then he could certainly be charged with that.
Thanks for the call, Ken. Jordan, your group tracks ethics, not just for presidents, but other members of government. I think a lot of people in the public might perceive politics in general as somewhat corrupt, generally corrupt from year to year, from party to party. The Trump administration, did it stand out to you when it came to ethics and concerns about corruption?
You know, it did. We don't like the idea that the government is necessarily corrupt or unethical. The vast majority of people who work for the government are doing it because they believe in working towards a better life for Americans. And we do what we do to get rid of the bad apples, to make sure that that is the reality. But with the Trump administration, the tone was really set at the top. And it all stems from the president's refusal to divest from his businesses. We've seen presidents for decades sell their assets, put the money in a blind trust or widely held funds. Reagan and Bush were both fantastically wealthy presidents and vice president, and they very famously put all their money in a blind trust upon taking office because they did not want Americans to ever question whether they were operating in their own interests. With President Trump, he seemed to go out of his way to direct government funds into his own business. And going back to Nixon released his tax returns with his famous speech, "The American people need to know the president is not a crook." Nixon was a crook, but at least he set this precedent of releasing his tax returns, and everyone else who came after him said essentially, well, if Nixon could do this, I can do this. So we never codified any of these things into law. And now it's clear that we need to, because we never assumed a president would be operating the government in his own self-interest. And it's not a party thing. Both parties have had presidents and administrations that generally operate ethically. But it has been a constant slog in the Trump administration. Every day seemed to be something new. And that's not something, we were here for Obama, we were here for Bush. It was never an everyday ethics job the way it became under President Trump.
in many ways, we relied on norms a lot to assume that these things wouldn't happen, that presidents and their staffs would act in the best interest of the country and not their own interests. Do you think we need to translate more norms into laws and regulations?
Without question. So many of the laws we have now came about 1977, 1978 or so, in the period post-Nixon. When they wrote those laws, they exempted the president from things like conflicts of interest laws because they figured, well, anything could be a conflict of interest for the president. And we got so used to presidents doing the right thing to avoid the appearance of ethics issues that we never felt the need to codify them until now. So there is legislation moving forward in Congress that we hope to see passed, starting with H.R. 1 and S.1, that would start codifying some of these things, because the worst thing we could see is now future presidents saying, well, Trump got to do this, so I'm going to do this. But we do think there is a good window here, both from Democrats who feel the need to prevent another Trump and prevent to show that they've done something about Trump, but also from Republicans who don't want to see a Democratic Trump, because, you know, I know there's this idea that people in Washington, it's all backroom deals and money changing hands, but the vast majority of them want a government that works in free and fair elections. And we have high hopes that there will be movement towards a more ethical government in the coming years.
Jordan, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jordan Leibowitz is Communications Director for Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. We talked to him today about the flurry of pardons and commutations former President Trump issued just before his term expired and an ethics order he revoked relating to lobbying. Coming up, technology companies have been under scrutiny since Russian social media campaigns influenced the 2016 election. We take a look at the future for social media platforms and federal regulation under a new administration. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+. After day one, what do we know about the new president's priorities? We'll find out and get your reactions to Joe Biden's inaugural address. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, after Trump supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol, Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey made the call to suspend President Trump's account. Other social media companies followed suit. As more details of the event have come out, it appears that some of the people involved had planned and coordinated their actions on social media accounts. Thousands of accounts that urged violence or spread QAnon conspiracy theories have since been removed from Twitter and other platforms. This is just the latest social media incident that's got attention from Congress. Members of both parties have raised concerns about the power of the biggest social media platforms, and there have been hearings raising issues about misinformation, disinformation, and claims of partisan bias. This could all lead to changes in the way those companies are regulated. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the power of the big social media platforms? Should the federal government step in and change the rules about how they're regulated? What do you think about the idea of treating them like public utilities? And what's your reaction to the type of speech that platforms themselves allow online? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Elizabeth Dwoskin is the Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. She's been covering social media companies and how they might be regulated under the Biden administration. Elizabeth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, take us back to, first of all, before January 6th. What kind of talk was there in Washington when it comes to, hey, maybe we need to change regulations on these big social media platforms?
I think that there was already a lot of momentum underway just by Biden winning. There was going to be a lot of momentum underway to make changes with social media. You have, you know, during the Obama administration, you have California passing during the Trump administration, you have California passing and enacting a landmark privacy act that is parallel to this privacy act that was passed in Europe. And there's been talk about, should we have some national privacy rules? I mean, you saw that during the Trump administration, you saw the Cambridge Analytica privacy scandal with Facebook, where the data of tens of millions of users was compromised. So I think that there was expected to be action on privacy. There's this bigger question, and this is even before the Capitol riots, you have the Democrats really, really wanting, and Joe Biden himself talked about it, the tech companies to take stronger responsibility for the kind of content that shows up on their platform, not just violence, but also hate speech. You heard a lot from the left about wanting the tech companies to make more interventions in the name of truth and preventing misinformation. If you heard Biden's inaugural speech yesterday, he talked about that as this being a time when truth itself is being questioned. And I know he's very angry at the social media platforms for that. But we also have, and Republicans were attacking the social media platforms for false allegations of political bias in many cases. So we just have this stew of we also have Russia hacking the country, issuing conducting a major hack, one of the biggest hacks in history, late last year, all this before the Capitol riots. So you have this stew of issues. And the way that I think about it is it's a new administration in Washington, but it's getting there's more and more pressure for big tech. More and more pressure on big tech. And that was before the Capitol riots.
Now, we've heard from various players in politics arguments that we need to change this Section 230 that it has to do with how social media platforms are regulated and how they're protected in some ways from responsibility for things that people post on them. We hear the phrase a lot. Can you give us the nutshell version of what Section 230 is and does?
Nutshell version is it's a 20-plus-year-old law that shields tech companies and internet companies from responsibility or legal liability from the stuff that gets posted on their services. So if you post something illegal on a tech service, the platform itself, the Facebook, the eBay, the Yelp, isn't responsible for that content, with the exception of some things like copyright and child porn, for example.
What kind of changes have people been calling for? And it might be different whether it's President Trump or the new President Biden.
Well, as I alluded to before, a lot of people have said, wow, Section 230 was created in a law that was 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago at this point, when the internet was very nascent and the companies needed protection because they were going to go out of business if they were going to be subject to lawsuits right and left about content. And so they got this kind of blanket immunity. But fast forward, here we are 20 plus years later, the tech companies and big tech are literally the most powerful companies in the world, the wealthiest and most powerful companies in the world. They have enormous resources. And people are saying, and they're responsible for free expression today. And what's been happening over the last few years is, as you know, these companies we saw the rise of, it wasn't just the Capitol riots that were organized on tech platforms. The neo-Nazi march in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017, in the first year of Trump's presidency, was also organized on Facebook and social media platforms. And there were conversations then to say, well, how should these companies bear more responsibility for facilitating this type of hate? And then you get into questions like advertising tools on these tech companies. Now, we have civil rights laws, which say, for example, that I cannot just offer a white person a credit card ad, but not offer a black person a credit card ad. But you have services on Facebook where you can have credit card ads, and you can tailor demographically who you want to target those ads to. So a lot of even civil rights leaders have brought lawsuits against Facebook in the last few years, saying that those targeting tools really violate the spirit of civil rights laws because you can exclude people. Like, I'm not allowed to put out a job ad that says people over 60 can't apply. But on Facebook, until some of these lawsuits, you could put out a job ad and then literally tailor what age groups you wanted that job ad to reach. So some lawyers have said that's a form of discrimination. So these are all like major questions about where should the law be in all this? And so far the law has been completely absent because the law literally says the tech companies aren't responsible for any of this. So there seems to be widespread agreement among both parties. It's one of the few things that both parties agree upon, which is that this does need to change. This regime needs to be overhauled. Even the lawmaker who created 230 said it needs to be changed. Biden said he was in favor of completely getting rid of the law. He said that on the campaign trail. But then the question becomes, what do we replace it with? And there's no widespread agreement. Like, try to get 1,000 Americans to agree on a definition of hate speech. It's pretty hard. But, you know, there are other things that might be a little bit less hard. For example, violence, you know, outright calls to violence or even subtle calls to violence. Now, some of that's illegal, you know, which is why you have law enforcement scouring the social media platforms. It's why platforms like Parler, where the Capitol riots were organized, are becoming like a crime scene right now. So certain things are just patently illegal when it's direct calls for violence. But what if you went a few shades under? Hateful calls, veiled calls for violence, should those be regulated as well? And should the government hold these giant social media companies responsible so that they have to remove this content with a certain period of time? They have to report it. These are all major questions that the Biden administration is likely to take on.
Talking to Elizabeth Dwoskin from The Washington Post, looking at the big social media companies and possibilities of changes, possibly big changes in the way they're regulated coming through Congress and the Biden administration. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Mike joins us now in Madison. Hello, Mike.
Good afternoon. My opinion is that social media corporations should be treated the same as every other corporation. If I were to walk into a corporation owned by Nancy Pelosi, Mitch McConnell, Joe Biden, or Donald Trump and wore a shirt that said, kill the owner of this company, I would more than likely be told I couldn't wear that shirt and more than likely fired. So I think Facebook doing the same thing, saying you can't have that bad stuff on there, should be the equivalent of regular corporate America.
Mike, thanks for the call. And Elizabeth, this has been an issue for the companies themselves, regardless of what the government says. What are you seeing from the big platforms about how and whether they're trying to clear up hate speech, borderline hate speech, calls for violence, veiled calls for violence on their own platforms?
Well, you know, what I'll say to Mike there is that you aren't actually, even on social platform allowed to say, I'm going to kill you right now. You're not allowed to actually say that's actually would be, you know, implicating yourself in a crime, and you're technically not allowed to do that. And that's why, as I said, some of these services are becoming crime scenes now in the wake of the Capitol riot. But there's millions of gradations. There's so much gray area about what you can say, and the platforms have had such wide latitude towards it. One of the scoops that I had last year was a story about how quietly Facebook has been really trying to like overhaul the way that they view hate speech. And what they've been trying to do is sort of say, well, can we look at certain types of attacks against certain types of peoples, groups that we know are really affiliated with hate speech, and take that stuff down really quickly. It's called the WOW project. It's an internal project going on at Facebook. WOW stands for the worst of the worst. And what they found is that statements, for example, against people of, and this was just from internal surveys they did like surveys with 16,000 people, where they found like people of mixed race, LGBTQ people, Muslims and Jews, they found in the surveys that those people are oftentimes the most subject to hateful attacks. And so they wanted to put high priority on language against when hateful language was directed at certain types of people. They want to take action on it more quickly. And they're debating that right now. But I think like just fundamentally, like we've seen over and over and over again, like look at what happened in your own state of Wisconsin and in Kenosha. There were groups that were planning violence and we're discussing things, you know, that were planning violence during the protest this summer. And Facebook didn't act, despite the fact that I think it was 350 different people reported these pages as problematic to Facebook. And they didn't even take action on their own reports. And, you know, that part of that led to the violence that took place. And so, you know, you look at that and you say, wow, if they're absolutely incapable right now, these are the richest companies in the world. What is going on that they're not capable then of even enforcing the rules that they say they have? And then you say, well, should the government step in? Should you create something like, you know, as Mike pointed out, you know, banking, there are other industries, healthcare, banking, those are much more regulated industries than tech. Should you create something like a CFPB? Remember, Elizabeth Warren ran for president. She created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that came after the financial crisis. And it was this extra, a new government agency that was essentially in standing for consumers' rights in the financial sphere. Well, should there be the Consumer Protection Agency for technology, something that does content moderation and regulation of the tech? I think that that's being discussed as well. And meanwhile, you have all these companies now that in the Trump years, you know, staffed up on Republicans and tried to create liaisons to the Trump administration, just politicking in Washington, lobbying. I think in the last 9 months of the year, big tech spent $59 million in lobbying. Or in the first 9 months of last year. And so I think what we're also seeing in this new era is we're seeing Biden appoint people who, just from reading the tea leaves already of the people he's appointed, those people are big critics of big tech. They're critics of Facebook. They're critics of Google. They think the government should do more. And those are the kind of people he's appointing. And I think that the companies themselves are like scrambling to hire Democrats because they hired a lot of Republicans during the Trump years. And
we're talking to Elizabeth Dwoskin, Silicon Valley correspondent at the Washington Post, looking at possible upcoming changes in regulations for social media companies. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see changes in regulations for the Facebooks and Twitters and Instagrams of the world? Do you have questions about how all this works? Call 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about how the Biden administration and Congress will approach technology companies, especially social media platforms. Elizabeth Dwoskin is with us. She covers the Silicon Valley for The Washington Post. You can join in at 800-642-1234. I want to get to another issue, political disinformation and misinformation. I want to go back to a congressional hearing from 2019, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg talking here, being questioned by New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez about lies and political ads.
So you won't take down lies or you will take down lies? I think it's just a pretty simple yes or no.
Congresswoman,
I'm not talking about spin. I'm talking about actual disinformation.
Yes, in most cases, in a democracy, okay. I believe that people should be able to see for themselves what politicians that they may or may not vote for
so
are
you
saying.
So you won't take them down.
Judge their character for themselves.
So you won't take, you may flag that it's wrong, but you won't take it down.
And that brings us, Liza, to another big question. You mentioned Russian information and disinformation, candidates and potential political lies on forums. What's the conversation about that now and whether the platforms are responsible for policing that sort of thing?
Well, I think it's a really complicated issue. Facebook has really come out of the gate and said, like you heard with Zuckerberg talking to Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, they don't believe that they should be the fact checkers. They have some fact checkers, but they've outsourced that to third parties. But I'll just take a step back and say, you know, during an election, when you see all those political ads on TV, nobody says to the TV station that the TV station should be fact checking those ads. So there is, so one of the things that Facebook will push back and say, well, is there a different standard for us than there even has been for all political ads? But in terms of misinformation and misleading information is one of the hardest problems, because when it's outright calls to violence, when it's threats, when it's white supremacy, it's going to be easier for the companies to get on board with law enforcement. They're going to take their cues from law enforcement, essentially, and they're going to do effectively what law enforcement tells them. But on issues of misinformation, you know, one of the greatest quotes I always heard was from an executive at Twitter who, like, this was like 10 years ago when they were starting Twitter. And he said, "We want Twitter to be the free speech wing of the free speech party." So if you take it in for a moment, they wanted Twitter, and you could say the same about Facebook, they wanted to be the most the biggest tent possible for every single voice. And both Zuckerberg and Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter, have long maintained that the best way to give everyone a voice is...
I think we lost our guest there. Liza, can you hear me? Well, I think she dropped out there. Well, let's bring on a caller or two on these issues and hear what you think. We've got John on the line in Madison. John, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. The thing that I just wanted to bring up is it seems to me absolutely ridiculous that Mark Zuckerberg and Jack from Twitter say that everybody needs a voice and free speech, because I think it may be mentioned this earlier in the show. I just joined it recently, but that, you know, Aaron Sorkin said everyone deserves a voice, but not everyone deserves a microphone. And to say that free speech means that you could be on a platform where millions of people can hear you is just irresponsible. And there should be regulations, just as the FCC regulates what you do on the airwaves or what television does on the airwaves. Someone wants to stand on a street corner and hand out pamphlets that talks about crazy conspiracy theories, that's fine. But to give them the avenue to do that to millions of people is dangerous. And it's absolutely insane that there is not regulation. That is not quelling free speech. That is just being responsible.
And John, you're looking for government regulation, or are you hoping that the platforms can police this on their own?
No, our government, doesn't the FCC every year, don't radio stations have to reapply for their license every few years to make sure that they're serving the public? So it doesn't have to be the fear that government is quelling free speech, just as they don't with the media. I don't think they do. Does the government regulates the media? You can't start swearing on your radio program.
That is accurate. I'm very careful not to do that. John, thanks a lot for that call. I think we have Liza back. Liza, our caller, John, saying, hey, there are FCC guidelines that regulate broadcasts and at least some things that can be said on the airwaves. John, hoping to see something similar, maybe even a little further, for Twitter and Facebook.
Well, he's absolutely right that there are regulations, but they're not required to do fact-checking. Now, I'm saying, so, you know, I'll tell you, that's Facebook's position. But I think, you know, this question of what kind of license, if you step back and say, what kind of role should political figures play on these platforms? These platforms, Facebook, I'll say Facebook and Twitter especially, were desperate to have political leaders on their platforms. They loved the attention that got. Twitter's slogan is literally something like, where news happens, be the place where the conversation happens. Their value, Twitter is a small company. They can punch above their weight with their influence because of all the newsmakers on their platform. And the top person of that was Donald Trump. We never had a president before. You know, Obama, he was on Twitter. But he effectively used the power of the presidency. He didn't try to extend the power of the presidency beyond just being the president, whereas Trump created a parallel megaphone on Twitter. I always remind everyone when he started his campaign, he had 3 million Twitter followers. On the day that Twitter removed him, banned him permanently, he had 88 million followers. So he used the presidency to hugely build and amplify his megaphone. And the philosophy of the leaders of these companies was, we want to be the place where news happens. And so we are not even going to apply our hate speech and other rules to political figures. We're going to treat them with kid gloves, because everything that they say is newsworthy. And so there's been many times over the years where people called out Facebook and Twitter and said, look at things that Trump said. Those things actually violate your rules. And if the companies had taken action on their rules, they would have shut Trump's voice off a long time ago. But they didn't want to censor the leader of the free world. And I think that the biggest question that these companies are going to have to face going forward is, what type of relationship do they want to have with these powerful figures that have the potential to, yes, make news, but also cause enormous harm in society with what they say? Do they want to apply the same rules? Do they want to apply a lower threshold for the rules? Do they want to apply a higher one because of the harms that they can cause? Or will the government just go and do it for them? I think I just saw the other day that Poland is passing a law in response to Twitter banning Trump. Poland is going to pass a law which says that social media platforms can't actually ban these political leaders, they can only take actions that will be illegal in the country. The social media, the law in Poland will say social media platforms can't go beyond what's actually just the laws on the books.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Elizabeth Dwoskin, Silicon Valley correspondent at The Washington Post, looking at social media companies and possible regulations coming from the Biden administration and Congress. Coming up next is news. Then a career transition expert gives advice to older workers on how to turn unemployment into opportunity. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.